This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here today with Jorge Ferrer of LifeRay.
Hello, I'm very glad to be here. I'm the Vice President of Engineering at LifeRay, and my work basically is to manage all the teams that are developing our products and their relationship with the community. We actually work very closely with our community. It's a very interesting job, and the end result is the products that we end up releasing.
You're one of those companies that's grown from open source into commercial, and it's always a very tricky balance to make. How do you keep your commercial customers and your open source customers both happy?
At times it's easy, but at times it's also very challenging. One of the tricks is being very honest, and being very honest to both, and being very clear about what are you expecting from it and what is the value that you are providing to each of them. And then you make decisions along the time, and then you also need to account for the fact that sometimes you make mistakes, and you need to be open. There has happened sometimes that we've made certain mistakes and we've had to be open about them and said to the community or to the customers, oh, you are right, because you're providing that feedback. I actually think there are no big secrets on this is the best open source commercial model and everybody needs to follow it. But it's a matter of making a small adjustment along the way, making sure that if you've made a mistake, then you course correct and then you continue.
Do you think the communities become more accepting of commercial involvement in open source and the fact that it always sits slightly behind where the community is?
It's improved because at first, most people involved in open source were more of idealists. That's actually very good, and there are still many of them, but there are also many more people who are also pragmatists. It's a good combination. Also within companies, they were seeing all these idealists and say, that's not for me. That's not for enterprise. But that's obviously changed a lot. And over the last years, there is lots of open source in any company. So they are used to it. And they are used to the fact that open source doesn't necessarily mean free in the sense that you don't have to pay, but it means free in the sense that I have some freedom. But because I have more freedom, I also have the responsibility to make the right decisions. And sometimes that means picking the commercial alternative or hiring companies that are contributing to the open source project.
One of the challenges of the discussion about using open source inside enterprises is we hear two phrases. First, it is free. You don't pay if you take the open source version. And secondly, all these people have looked at the code. Let's quickly talk about the first one. It's not really free, is it, for them if they take the open source? Because they have to learn about it, teach their developers, do all the debug. So how do we get away from this perception that open source means you're running with scary, untested, unproven code?
That's a very good point. And actually, just talking about it and making it clear, each of us involved in open source need to do. And obviously, it's going to take its time, and it actually improved a lot. But you are very right, especially when we're talking about software for enterprises. There is always costs involved in getting the software, even if the bytes are free. Yeah, you need to choose the software, you need to evaluate it, you need to install it, you need to do a lot of things. So it's never fully free. You need to, at the very least, pay for the time of the people within your company who are involved in it. Sometimes it's actually cheaper to hire someone to do it for you. And sometimes maybe the company or the companies who are most involved actually can provide a much better return on investment than just spending your own time. So that's something that I think it needs to continue to be explained. It's also something that as companies adopt open source, they also become more aware of it.
The other side of this, the second part, is the whole issue of code stability. The argument that lots of people have seen the code, they've looked at the code, therefore you can trust the code, as we found with OpenSSL and a number of other high-profile instances recently, isn't always the case. Just because a project's been around a long time doesn't mean to say lots of people have looked at it. Where does that bring the advantage for using an enterprise version of open source into play?
First of all, actually having more eyes looking at code, it's always better. The fact that it's open source, it's actually obviously going to make it easier. That's a very good characteristic of open source. Now, if we are talking about guarantees, it's no guarantee. Actually, all software has bugs, and that's something you cannot solve. But having more eyes look at it will mean it has less bugs. But it doesn't mean it has no bugs. So that's where certain enterprise commercial services on top of open source chime in. But not only that, if it's enterprise software, then I think it's also very important that the open source projects, the people responsible for it, whether it's a company, a set of companies, need to have very strict processes for the code that comes in, regardless of whether it's paid contributors or by volunteer contributors. For example, we at LifeRay have a very strict review process. Every single line of code has to meet a set of guidelines that we have, especially around consistency and following patterns that we know work, that don't have security issues, that don't have bugs that we know we've made in the past and we want to prevent. So I think that's something that any open source project that it's actually going to be used for any that is critical should follow. And that adds to the many eyeballs, which also helps, of course, but it's not enough sometimes.
From an enterprise perspective, that's great because they know they've got a trusted product. But how do you then take that back to the community? Because you mentioned guidelines and patterns. How open do you find a lot of community developers are when you say, we understand it's open source, but actually, while we'd like your contributions, we really do need to put down some lines in the sand that you have to adhere to?
It's a challenge, and sometimes we do fear that because of these strict rules, we may be making it harder for people to contribute. And that's actually something that is very hard to measure, and it may be happening. But at the same time, it's necessary, and the contributors that are really interested actually end up getting it, and they thank us for it. Because they say, I know exactly how I need to do things to get into the product, and the result is actually better.
How do we reward contributors? Because if we go back to the early stages of open source, as you said, it started with idealists, people who just had a view that we could make a different world. Now, there are millions, if not billions, of lines of code sitting out in code repositories that people have written over the years, many of which get no recognition, no reward for the time and effort people have put in, and they've had to learn these skills. How do you look at your community and say, okay, that was a really nice piece of code, that was a really good idea, we're going to use it in a commercial product, but for that, we will reward you?
One of the things that we do is every single contribution that is made, when we take it, we make a pledge. This is going to be part of our open source product that you're contributing to. We don't take contributions just to put it in a commercial product only. So I think that's very important. Then the second part is that it's also the basis, is recognition. Every single recognition needs to be publicly acknowledged and thanked for, regardless of whether it's code contribution, regardless of whether it's someone participating in the forums and answering a lot of questions or providing good ideas. We actually have a team, which is the developer relations team, who is looking at these things and actually doing prizes. Like in this event, we have prizes for some of the community contributors that have contributed the most. And some of them are not even coders. They might be designers, they might be users. So I think that's a big part of it. Then there are other ways of acknowledging, but they are more tricky and it's not something that we are doing right now. No, they are not. And actually, it is challenging. I would even say
you mentioned people other than coders, which I think is something often overlooked when we think about open source. There are people who choose to review code, but they may not necessarily be developers for the bulk of their time. They may also be users who like what they see and they're willing to look at new versions. How do you widen the scope of these people? Because they're not the natural open source community group, are they?
No, they are not. And actually, it is challenging. I would even say that we're not doing a terrific job at doing it. But the good news is we actually get those type of community members. And we get search engine optimization experts. We actually have within our local user groups quite a few of them, and we haven't done anything about it. Even if we haven't done much to do it, actually contributing to open source projects sometimes is enough of a reward. You get back even if the organization behind it is not doing anything explicitly to track you. And that's actually what we are seeing. Sometimes we take for granted that the community contributors, the people that come to our events and want to contribute, are developers, and sometimes they are not. They are designers, they are people just experts in documenting and trainers. We really love and we really value the contributions they make in the form of ideas and suggestions.
How do you reach further out into different groups? For example, one of the key elements of a library is all about the user experience. And that requires people who are not connected to the software industry. It is about psychologists. It's about people who understand behavioral patterns. They're not a naturally collaborative group of individuals. How hard is it to get their input to make sure that the product works?
Our particular experience is that in order to get much better at user experience, we've had to hire a good and strong team of internal designers. And that's come first. And once we've had that, and we've improved over the years, but especially in the last year, it's when we've really built a very strong team, you see that they are actually more collaborative than it may seem. And they have these social networks where they like to post all of their work. And it's then when they start getting some peers who may not be interested in your specific piece of software, but they are interested in the specific interaction or design that our designers are posting online. And they start making suggestions and giving ideas. And they do collaborate and acknowledge each other. And that's where they help.
So out of interest, how many of your staff that you have now and how much of your recruitment actually comes from the community as opposed to people who've had little to no interaction with Liferay in the past?
It's a very good question. Actually, we hire a lot of people from the community. Especially at the beginning, we had this rule that we wanted to hire the best people out there wherever they are in the world. We are still doing that. In combination of doing that, we also have some larger development centers right now in the specific centers of the world, which happen to be the places where we found most community members to begin with. I don't have any specific percentages, but I can say that whenever someone becomes very engaged in the community, there is very often a mutual love relationship where they really like the company and they like our values, even beyond open source, which is what attracted them. So they start wanting to work for Liferay and they suggested. It happens very often.
One of the big changes we're seeing in software development now is the focus on APIs. And ironically, it's a little like the Wild West of sort of late 1980s, early 1990s with code libraries. And also, as we saw around 2000, with web services. There's a lot of stuff out there. The challenge is, what do you trust? What do you invest in? How do you integrate the APIs? Or how do you create a system where people can integrate an API? What are the challenges that you are looking at the moment?
Probably the number one challenge that we are looking at the moment with APIs is this concept of evolvability. Basically, it means when you create an API, you need to account for the fact that you're going to need to change it. You're going to need to evolve it. But at the same time, sometimes you're asking people you have no relationship or little relationship with to use your API for a wide variety of things, and sometimes for a wide variety of devices you don't even know about. They are trusting you that their investment is going to pay off. So if you change your API because you want to add this new feature that is important for you, but in order to do so, you break the consumers that they may have built, then that relationship is broken. We've seen a lot of examples of that in the big APIs out there. We actually started a few months ago to research on this topic because we think there has to be a better way. And actually there is. There is people out there talking about this, still in small groups, and we actually want to help talk more about it and here promote these ideas. We're looking at ideas that were discarded not so long ago, such as using hypermedia in APIs. And we're looking at ideas about using more standards as part of the APIs. While we were a little bit skeptics ourselves when we started this, we thought it was worth researching it. We've been making a lot of progress, doing especially proof of concepts, and we are amazed. You can actually do APIs that are much more evolvable than what are the common standards nowadays.
What is holding people back? Because if we think about code, we know how to write code. We know how to do peer review. We know how to stabilize our code. We know that when we issue a patch, we need to inform customers what version of the code has changed, why it's changed, what the patch relates to. APIs have been around a long time, but in reality, they're very early into this game. Are you seeing people now taking that experience of writing software applications and applying that engineering focus to APIs, or are we still trying to make that transition?
I don't think I have a definitive answer for why this is happening, but I think I have at least some clues. One of them is precisely along what you're saying, which is the people creating the APIs are more often thinking about their internal systems, what they've built, how to expose it, versus thinking, what are my consumers going to build? What is their language? What's their terminology? Not only that makes it harder to use that API, but eventually your internal systems will change. And maybe what the consumers of that API are trying to do is the same thing. So if you had based your API on those terms, you wouldn't change. But you've based it on your own internal types, data models, etc. So your API changes. And you explain to your consumers, hey, I'm sorry, but I had to change it. And you have no choice at that point. So what is the solution? The solution is you need to think in terms of who is going to use your API and create an abstraction layer over what you are doing. And it's not so hard to do that. And when you realize, you say, how come nobody is doing this? There is a long history of that, especially in the world of web APIs, with people not understanding REST and saying HTTP is wrong because it has no sessions. We're way past that now, and everybody understands there are many benefits to stateless. But then there is this other part of REST, which is very important, which is hypermedia. We are where we used to be with sessions. People still don't acknowledge it. But there are very important people in the API space, like Mike Amundsen, writing books about this. And that's one of the things that opened their eyes, and I think it's one of the things that will open the eyes of many more people.
One of the interesting things about APIs is that companies are being persuaded to open their internal systems, part of digital transformation, but also just to get a wider market. These companies are not geared up to be software organizations. Therefore, getting to know who those customers are, getting to know how to package and produce and deliver these APIs is a significant hurdle for them. Do you see a problem for these companies as they move forward? And is there a need for more professional help for them to understand how to develop, deploy, and maintain APIs?
Absolutely. That's actually the big challenge. And opening up this API is, even in some industry, going to make a difference on who makes it and who gets obsolete. I definitely think that there is a market both for professional help or even new products that are out there. For example, one of the cool new markets of products is API gateways. I do think it's still in the early stages, and think it's necessary for that market also to keep in mind this idea of not only exposing whatever there is, but actually map to the needs and the terminology of the consumers.
As we look forward over the next year, what can your own customers expect to see from you?
We are actually planning to release a new version of our key product, Library DXP, next year. And it's going to have a big emphasis on APIs, and especially evolvable APIs. We're putting our words right now. It's going to facilitate much more using Library as a headless platform. We believe that's very important, and it's a very good complement to the way many users are using Library right now, which is through its UIs. And it enables our customers to actually use Library for a whole new breed of applications and devices.
Jorge, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.